This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
In this meditation world, Dharma world, there's a lot of talk about being present, and even a t-shirt that says, "Be present." And when I started practicing, I heard that just as I'm going to say, "Be present tonight." But I was kind of like, has anybody told the teachers that the present kind of sucks? Like, somebody going to share that? Because the present, as I experience it, is difficult. So what does that mean to be present? And why? And as we appreciate practice more, we find that the present only sucks at the top couple layers. That we're actually still very much living in the world of past and future. When the present sucks. And it's true that sometimes the present will contain difficulty. But I think we need to be present because what we do not notice, we become. What we do not notice, we become that. So an angry thought, a restless thought arises. Tonight I'm going to talk about anxiety and worry, working with that. And when this arises, if it's unnoticed, if it's beneath the radar of our mindfulness, we embody anger or we embody restlessness because there's no space for us to be anything else. It's like when we watch a movie, you know, when you watch a movie and you get completely engrossed, like you really, it's like you're the protagonist in the movie, sort of, you're really effectively living in the movie. And if you ever watch somebody watching a movie, they're really embedded in that narrative, really living it as if it's their life. And our tendencies towards unconsciousness, towards not noticing, keep us living in a kind of movie. And we've sort of entrusted ourselves to the director of the movie. And really, what's directing the movie, what's shaping our experience of life, are our habits. And so the practice of mindfulness is one sometimes translated as remembering. We're remembering. Because in that mode of forgetfulness, it's not a moral sin. We can't be harsh on ourselves. It's the natural default position of the mind in some way. But when we are in that state of unmindfulness, we forget the Buddha's deepest teachings of impermanence. That we really live in the realm of permanence. I hope this makes sense. That when we're not paying attention, we totally forget that everything is changing. We forget who we are in the deepest sense. So mindfulness is a form of remembering, of breaking the illusion, of actually waking up to the movie. And it doesn't mean that we have to hate the movie, or that it exists, or that we sometimes fall into the trance of our story. But just to know that mindfulness brings some space around that. We're not totally defined for by it. And in that way, we can begin to free the heart from some of our habits of judgment and self-harshness. Apparently, at UCLA, when they do this as a subject, it's one of the ones that very reliably sells out. Anxiety and self-harshness. It was interesting when I heard that. So this is a description of worry from a researcher, actually. He's sort of the guru of worry research. Which, believe it or not, is a very legitimate scientific field, because we all know it so deeply, and is actually, when it reaches very high levels, is the most common way of mental disorder, whatever. That's awkward way to put it. It's very much, we're all on the continuum somewhere, is basically how anxiety is. So this is not Pema Chodron or Jack Kornfield. This is Dr. Thomas Borkovec. And he's writing a kind of reflective piece, actually. So he's including himself in this. It says, when I'm worrying, I'm mostly engaged in thought or talking to myself. This thinking, triggered by internal or external cues that signal danger, primarily concerns the future, and involves the anxious anticipation of and attempts to avoid the many negative events I imagine might happen. The consequence of any perception of threat is the activation of basic fight or flight reactions, motivating attempts to escape or avoid. Quite naturally, under these circumstances, I feel compelled to figure out how to prevent these bad things from happening, or how to prepare for the worst. Worrying is a device that I believe can function to do this. Because I'm devoting large amounts of time to generating and attending to worrisome thoughts, much of my life is spent living in an illusion. All right. I don't know if he's a meditator. I think he actually is. But that's a really beautiful description of what it's like to worry. And it does keep us very buffered from our own lives. Now, important to acknowledge, even before we begin, that the arising of fear is a natural conditioned response. That one of my teachers said, in looking at evolution, you know, that we've come from other species, and if those other species from which we've evolved got to the edge of a cliff and had this warm, gooey feeling of like, fun. they would not be our ancestors. If they did not have some mechanisms of fear to alert them to this basic kind of need for survival, they would not have lived. They would not be our genetic grandparents. But they are, and so we find ourselves here living very deeply in fear. And worry is one example of it. Worry is one example. But important not to push up against the tendency of us, our minds, to become fearful. And instead, bring some of that awareness, some of that intelligence to our reactivity. That in the same way I was speaking, that what is unnoticed we become, same with fear. Fear that is unknown to awareness inhabits us. And It's a very, very contractive, isolating experience for me. That I find any time I'm actually able to break through some fear, invariably there's some sense of release, some sense of release. So this is a dominant experience in our lives, and I want to talk about some of the ways that Buddhism addresses it. Some of them are in the short term. Many of them are the progression and accumulation of the Dharma over time. So I want to give some strategies for dealing with it now. But I think most of it is that we are learning to relate to experience in such a radically new way that some of the conditions for anxiety to arise begin to dissolve. So here, while we're in Sangha, we can sort of trust that the fight or flight reaction can be put aside, right? Because we're pretty safe, right? Not just an atmosphere of physical safety, but of emotional safety. And so we're so accustomed to focusing on, at some level, the survival strategy, even if we're not so conscious of that. Here we can kind of bracket that. Meditation, Dharma, we can bracket that and begin to look at the habits that may be helpful and may be complicating for us. So something that to notice about fear, and this is the process of becoming intimate, is that it is always in the future. Right? Is there any fear of what's now? And Jack Kornfield, to illustrate this, tells this story of, you know, somebody who sees, it's not a true story, but somebody who's going to take a hike and they see the sign, bears in the area. And they're like, oh God, there are bears in the area. I'm afraid to see a bear. Not the sign, but I'm afraid to see a bear. Then they see bear tracks. And again, it's like, oh shit, I'm going to see a bear. It's not the tracks. Then they see a bear. It's not seeing the bear. It's the bear's going to bite me. The bear comes and bites them. It's not I'm afraid of being bitten. It's I'm afraid of dying. And that profound future orientation must be acknowledged. So we look, what is the nature of worry, of anxiety? There's activity in the mind and activity in the body. In the body, just as when there was an itch, there is a sense of profound urgency. It's like if our emotional body could speak, it would be saying, you need to act. You need to do something. That something is not right. And maybe some of the time, that's a wise message to heed, right? Like our ancestors at the edge of the cliff. But fear is so taken over consciousness that even when we're not at risk, we feel threatened. We're seeing signals of danger. And the body, being so sensitive, reacts. And that kind of gets this momentum moving towards action, because we envision that only acting or thinking about acting can relieve us. Mindfulness brings us back to this wordless, open-hearted acceptance of the body that is restless. In the mind, we're simulating the future, envisioning pathways of this choice or that choice. And it's amazing how profound the mind's influence is. That I could be just sitting here and I'll think of one course of action and then think of another. And it's like when I think of that first course, this whole world blossoms. It's as if it's happened. And then the next world blossoms. The power of the mind to do that, to create these imaginary futures, is staggering. And so in practice, we can begin to appreciate this blossoming process, which is very compelling, but is an illusion. You know, there's this real deep sense that we're always at a fork in the road. That with our decisions and our worries, we often feel like we've arrived at a kind of defining moment. And we are going to choose the right path or the wrong path. Or they're both wrong, but one is a little less wrong. And I don't think that's how it is. We sort of overestimate the power of those kinds of choices to affect our well-being at the deepest level. That's how we envision our happiness, is making the right choice. But my experience is those pivotal kind of moments, I don't even remember them. I don't even remember what my... Maybe there are some in our lives where we really shaped our life in a profound way by making a choice. I'm not discounting that. But there's a sense that we're always at that critical juncture. And this way is towards good and this is towards bad. I don't think it's like that. That more important in our future well-being is how we're cultivating our hearts now. That the kind of stories we have that we tell about what will make us happy are, I think, often short-sighted. And what's actually most determining of our happiness in the future is how well we're caring for our hearts now. And I think meditation practice gives us some confidence in this. It actually begins to create some sense of safety. Knowing, and just really beginning to trust, and it's not something you can just hear and believe. Have to actually trust that it is the open heart that is most important in our sense of well-being. And through the years of practice, I have begun to trust in that. And trusting that we're laying the groundwork, we're planting the seeds of future happiness now in a very non-anxious way of just living in accord with our own deepest intention. Of practicing awareness and compassion. That this is not the kind of thing that we have to be anxious about. We're anxious about outcomes and achievements. It's not going to make or break us. And so we develop the confidence of the heart and the confidence of equanimity that we can be with what comes. We begin to tolerate uncertainty without transforming it into anxiety. That we're living in this realm of impermanence and we're seeking the solid footing. We're building houses on very unstable ground. And my tendency to do that runs really deeply. I find myself building the house again and again. But I know at some level that I'm building it on quicksand. And that this is not a strategy that can work, not in this realm of impermanence. And this confidence of the heart allows us to let go of attachment to outcome. Like, I'm going to be graduating next year, and I have no idea what my life will look like. I don't know if I'll be living here or not. I don't know. But I have a lot of trust that the Dharma will take care of me. That the open-heartedness that I'm attempting to cultivate now will be what I can trust for the future. Maybe we can see in our own life that at some level we do believe in worry. That there's something about the habit of imagining one path or another path and sort of following all the links and imagining different futures, different worlds, basically. Something that we think is helpful for managing life. And I'm not claiming that all anxiety or all, you know, quote, worry is useless. But we're probably out of balance in how we relate to uncertainty. That the way one person's characterized it is that anxiety is really the unwillingness to tolerate uncertainty. And there's some sense of redemption that maybe we can stay totally safe if we just envision one future, envision another, keep simulating the future in our mind. That we believe in worry in this way. And it can get us very isolated. It can get us really, that claustrophobia I talked about, I think there are a few things more than worrying that gets you really into like the back corner of your mind and very cut off from life, very cut off from life, and really cut off from our own hearts in the process. So, on the one hand, we do need to acknowledge that sometimes anxiety is of benefit for us. That it keeps us from doing things that will have really bad consequences sometimes. It may keep us from making moral decisions that we'll regret. That there's some anxiousness around doing something really harmful. And that's okay. That actually, the Buddha encourages that sense of fear. That it's okay to be afraid of harming people. That this is skillful. And in fact, in studies of like people with psychopathy, psychopaths. They actually, so people who very consistently violate the will of other people, they actually lack some fear mechanism. That if you bring a person with psychopathy into a laboratory and say, we're going to shock your arm and it's going to hurt a lot, they're less afraid. Less afraid than people, more typical people. And so, you know, I don't think we should, the idea is not to abolish fear entirely, but the power of fear to run our lives is deeper than we realize. It just recently I was, you know, are the habits that are sort of most destructive in some ways are so broad and have such deep roots that we don't even know them as habits. And I was just seeing this kind of mechanism of fear in my own life and how it really buffers me from life and keeps, it just builds a kind of deadness into life. And any time that I do find I can move through fear, it's a very liberating feeling, very freeing kind of feeling. So this intolerance of uncertainty, where we're living in this kind of the first teaching in Buddhism is often impermanence of a Nietzsche in Pali, that everything that is born dies. Everything that is born dies. Anything, all phenomena that arise will pass. And this phenomena means me and you and this meditation center and everything we know as an object, everything we know. And yet there's a kind of uneasiness in the heart to take that in real fully. And so we can all say in a kind of intellectual way of, yeah, everything passes. Everything that is born dies, including me. But my experience is that to really take that in, it happens at multiple levels. Multiple levels. The teachings have been described not as horizontal but vertical. They're aligned like this. They come in more deeply. More deeply. And it's said that if we can understand impermanence, that this actually cracks open the mind in a new way. One experience was 9/11. When I woke up and heard that news, it was so disorienting and frightening for me. And part of what crumbled for me in that experience was the sense that something, someone, some force was keeping me safe. That I had been able to live in that illusion of safety. 23 years, 25 years of safety, sense of, at some deep level, I am protected. That there's something, I couldn't articulate what that was, and couldn't say, yeah, I didn't believe in God or anything like that, but there was just a sense of, if I go about my life and live in a kind of careful way, I'm safe. And when I saw those images, it, like that, just shattered. And there was this sense of real groundlessness. That my mind is always retreating to ground. It's always retreating to stability and security and a sense of place, a sense of stable footing. And that day, something shifted. And it's not that I don't still revert to that illusion often. That's kind of like my default position, in fact, is to think that things are permanent. That when we look real closely, we're usually believing in permanence. But that day helped break some of those bonds for me. And that groundlessness that I think a lot of people experienced, sometimes is perceived as fearful or creates some anxiety. that we can never really get our footing and find a resting place. I think many people experience that as fearful, but often very open-heartedly, that it actually many, many people experience the kind of open-heartedness that comes with that sense of groundlessness. So I wanted to read something from Pema Chodron. Says, moving away from experience, moving away from the present moment with all our habits and strategies, always adds up to restlessness. The comfort that we associate with concretizing and making things solid is so short-lived. Moving into our experience, whether it's opening to love or the closing down experience of resentment and separation, brings us an enormous sense of freedom. The freedom of nothing solid. Something about nothing solid begins to equal freedom. In the meantime, we discover that we would rather feel fully present to our lives than be off trying to make everything solid and secure by engaging our fantasies or our addictive patterns. We realize that connecting with our experience by meeting it feels better than resisting it and by moving away. Being on the spot, even if it hurts, is preferable to avoiding. As we practice moving into the present moment this way, we become more familiar with groundlessness, a fresh state of being that is available to us on an ongoing basis. This moving away from comfort and security, this stepping out into what is unknown and shaky, that's called liberation. So this is a theme of Dharma practice, and I think an important antidote to anxiety. That we can actually relate to the impermanence of this life in ways that lead to less anxiety and not more. That we begin to sense the futility of making that ground solid. And something releases. Something releases. We see how tightly we hold on to conditions and how deeply we wish and long for permanence. But that longing is a setup. It can only end in suffering. To wish for permanence in a world where nothing stays the same. In working with anxiety, another aspect of the teaching that's been helpful is around transparency, that I'm most anxious when I feel like I can be found out. When I feel like somebody could say something and I would have to say, like, yeah, you caught me. You know that feeling of living in a way that's not genuine, not consistent with our own integrity, not consistent with how we are in other spheres of life, having very different roles. And so, like, when I give a presentation on research. Even though I'm not talking out of my ass, I feel a tiny bit like a fraud. Like there's just this subtle sense that the way I'm presenting the material, presenting the data, there's a little bit of posturing as knowing it better than I do, of being a little bit more secure with it than I am. And there's just this subtle sense of I could be found out. I could be sort of revealed in some way. And there's a kind of kernel of anxiety that comes with that. And a lot of our lives, I think we feel like we could be found out. One of the things that's been most relieving about the Dharma and even talking about it, and why I don't feel nervous talking about it, is that it's just kind of offered as reflections on our own experience. That even though I'm doubtless wrong about many things about this practice, and short-sighted, and my insight will grow over time, I'm doing my best, and I don't feel like I'm presenting it as something other than it is. I don't feel like I could be found out here. I don't feel like there could be a question asked where I would have to say, you know what, you're right, I'm a fraud. And that sense of not having anything to hide is very freeing. Very freeing kind of feeling. And the Dharma moves our life in the direction of transparency, of more integration, more a sense of our life being of a single piece. That we are not so split off in different roles, that we don't feel like we have as much to hide, that we're less shameful about who we are, about our lives, about our history, that we begin to become more and more whole. And that sense of not being able to be found out puts the heart at ease. It puts the heart at ease. This practice is also about working with our identifications. That we were talking about the flavor of awareness, that flavor, that sense that awareness is flavored by self, flavored by a sense of I am. That's at the subtle level, but there are many things that we think we are. And when we take a lot of pride, when we take a lot of solace in being something, it's a setup for anxiety. Yeah, Marla.
I've once heard something that I want to share. And it made sense to me. I heard that worrying is like praying for the things that you don't want. And and my personal opinion is that if the worrying is helping you in some way, then keep doing it. But if the worrying is not helping you, then stop. Stop doing it. Just stop.
It's hard because it's sticky. It's sticky. Maybe if I had you following me around, say, stop it, Matt. Stop it. That would be helpful. But it's kind of like usually we feel like we're getting some work done. Like sometimes if I have a meditation that's really spacey, the feeling is one of like, okay, I'm sitting here, but I'm getting shit done. Like, it's all happening in my head and everybody's eyes are closed, but I'm getting stuff done. That worrying's doing something. And it usually feels that way, even though, as you say, it's not. So these kind of, the stickiness to roles is something, is another aspect of anxiety, that if we insist on being this or that, we're in a vulnerable position. That if we live by the ego, we will die by the ego too. That if we live for the validation of our roles, we die by it too. And so I was giving a talk to a group at an academic conference on mindfulness, though, and one person was moved to tears and another was like in a catatonic sleep. Like, he looked completely anesthetized. It's just, and it's both. So what am I to do? What's the ego to do? Right? If I crave the woman moved to tears, it brings, you know, the guy who is completely unconscious is going to hurt a lot. If I depend on the woman, the heart breaks with the man. And it's not that we don't want to be effective or skillful, but if we invest deeply in those roles, we are locked into a kind of restless suffering, of scrambling to support our ideas of who we are. And the world does not tolerate our ideas of who we are. It doesn't. The practice is often described as cultivating equanimity. That when I'm asking for us to let go of thought, to open the heart to what's difficult, to find space for everything to take its place, for the agitation and the fear, for all of that to take its place. This is the cultivation of equanimity, which sometimes is called, my teacher Shinzen calls it, a radical permission to feel. A radical permission to allow what is arising to arise and actually to feel it, to be present to it. And one aspect of worry is that we envision that the heart can be overwhelmed, that there are things that will be too much for us. And as we practice, we develop more and more trust in the capacity of the heart to open even to what is exquisitely difficult. That I remember on my first retreat of doing intensive practice for a week, I was so afraid of the physical pain, the emotional pain that I imagined might arise, that when I began to develop some level of equanimity, I saw that so much of the pain I was experiencing was the anxious anticipation of how much worse it could get. And when the fear began to subside, the trust that, oh, I can open to this too, things got a lot easier, a lot easier. That the fear of pain runs so deep. But if we can develop the kind of meditative skills to trust our capacity to open, to not suffer horribly, even in the difficult, we can live a less anxious life. And as we practice and as we begin to cultivate this trust in, I trust in the heart, trust in equanimity, I don't know, we can call it different things. Trust in that all of life can teach us, that life is here to help free the heart. When we develop a real abiding trust in that, we settle into our lives in a different way. And it's really this trust that how we're caring for our hearts now is the most important aspect of our future well-being. That the world is going to do its thing and we're going to be greeted with joys and sorrows for sure. But this sense that we're actually planting the seeds of open-heartedness, of compassion, now is how we best take care of the future. The mind wants to plan it out and strategize the path through a way out of pain and into pleasure and safety. And this is the function of worry, to find that path that through the labyrinth of difficulty. And the Buddha says, don't bother. Don't bother. Work now. Work now to open the heart more deeply. That this is the most powerful factor in determining our future. And I do trust that. And I saw that working with hospice patients who by definition are usually within 6 months of their death. And the only thing that really mattered to them was how well they loved through their life. That was it. When we really got down to what was of meaning to them, it was a question of the openness of their hearts. And that's what brought well-being, or that's what brought agitation and fear. And so I think this practice is worthy. This practice of opening the heart is worthy. And over time does help us learn to trust the unfolding of our lives in a new way, in a way that's not anxious, that just knows that we care for our hearts now, and that's about as much as we can do. So few minutes for questions.
I wanted to add something about the, you're talking about anxiety, and something I was reading recently, it's like a method to deal with anxiety that was taken from Thich Nhat Hanh. It's not his writing, but it's adapted from his stuff, is a way to be accepting of the situation that you're in and whatever eventuality may come of it. Instead of thinking about it, the way to accept it is to realize that wherever you are, you're held by whatever it is, whether it's your clothing, or the air molecules around you,
yeah,
or the seat that you're sitting in, or the earth under your feet. You know, just recognizing that you're okay. You know, like, it's a good way to hook your mind out of anxiety and panic.
Yeah.
And come back to the present moment.
Yeah.
In your body.
That's nice. And also what I hear and what you're saying is that we're cultivating a sense of connection, that there is nothing more isolating than anxiety, and or really suffering in general is like a disease of isolation. And the Dharma takes us to just the whole way we're moving towards connection. And that's that is, I think, an antidote, as you're saying. Yes, yeah.
Can you speak about balance of accepting, you know, maybe a situation and what is in the present moment, and, you know, in that versus wanting to change things, I guess being more, taking more proactive, that balance between being proactive with changing your situation versus accepting your situation.
Yeah.
I think that's where I sometimes personally get anxieties trying to figure out if I should just let things kind of be and just go with the flow, or really kind of take control of it and change it. You know,
Yeah. Well, one thing that came to mind is, I think I've mentioned this, you know, there's some Seinfeld episode where George Costanza, everybody know Costanza? He just starts doing exactly the opposite of his impulse all the time. And he finds that his life is sort of going a lot better. Yeah, I think he even called himself like the anti-George or something. It was something fun. Anyway, so with these kinds of questions, that comes to mind, that what we usually do, probably do something else. So if we're the kind who sort of accepts like really messed up situations and is just sort of like, oh, I just should just keep cool, it's all right, act. If we're the kind who's always tinkering and trying to maximize and make everything just right, let it go. And beyond that guidance, I don't know if I could, it would probably be sort of case by case. Maybe one or two more. Yeah.
This may be a little bit outside of usual practice, but one thing that really helped me with anxiety several years ago, it's kind of, was simply to recognize that a lot of the things that I was anxious about, or whenever there was some intense emotion that involved some other person, I would just remind myself that they're not coming to kick my ass. I mean, really. I mean, there's so many things that I get caught up with. And when I kind of just take a deep breath and realize, nobody's really, you know, nobody's holding a gun to my head.
Yeah.
You know, whatever's going on, I'm really kind of doing it to myself right now.
Hmm.
It really has been profoundly helpful for me.
Great. That's great. You know, I was working with this this guy who in a mental health clinic, and he had been homeless for a couple decades, and a really wise guy. He was super depressed, just barely kind of hanging on. And I remember, and he had cancer. And I remember we were talking one time, and he said, you know, he was sort of going on about his struggles and problems. And then he paused, and then he just kind of looked at his body and looked at me, and he said, like, where are my problems? And it was really born of a lot of insight, because as you're suggesting, it's like, where are they? See how imposing and real they feel, how much the mind creates these house of cards again and again and again, and we believe in them, and then they fall. The house of cards falls, and what we thought was the problem doesn't come to pass, or it's different than we thought, but we build another house of cards, that this is the habit of the mind. And meditation practice is really seeing how that the mind creates, how it fabricates suffering. How it fabricates suffering. So we have to stop. That was not the talk. I forgot everything I was going to say, actually.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.